Welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine publishes original crime and mystery short stories, and in our podcast series, we present readings of stories from our back issues. In this episode, Elizabeth Selvin reads her story, A Work in Progress, from our May-June 2019 issue. Elizabeth Selvin is a psychotherapist and social worker. She has directed alcohol treatment programs and written extensively on addiction, codependency, and dysfunctional relationships. So it's no surprise that she centered a series of mysteries around Bruce Kohler, a recovering alcoholic. She is also the author of the Mendoza Family Saga, a historical series featuring Diego Mendoza, a young Jewish sailor on Columbus's second voyage to America. Most recently, she edited an anthology called Me Too Short Stories, published by Level Best Books. She will discuss her new anthology, as well as her inspiration for this story, A Work in Progress, following her reading.
Giant fans rustled all around me, high overhead, the vast leaves of the palm trees, and on either side of the creaking wooden walkway under my pounding feet, saw palmettos in constant motion as armadillos threaded their stealthy way beneath them. The only other sounds were the jingling of crickets and the occasional cry of an unseen bird. I had to admit the little literate could write. She had certainly captured the setting of the North Florida Center for the Arts, where we had both been awarded coveted associate residencies for 3 weeks, with the proverbial room of our own and daily workshops with an acclaimed master artist. Calendula Falk was one of that rare breed, a crime novelist whom the literati took seriously. Along with her Edgars and Daggers, she'd been shortlisted for the Pulitzer and the National Book Award. The 8 associate artists she'd handpicked came from all over the country. We ranged in age from 22, the precocious Miss Muppet, to 62. That would be me, currently refusing to divorce the man who'd left me for this clever little tart. The nubile Ashley had parlayed a grad student thesis advisor flirtation into a wrecked home and a tenure-track job at a prestigious university. She certainly hadn't taken Jack from me for his beaux yeux. I remembered those eyes before glaucoma and incipient cataracts had faded their blue sparkle, before the faint laugh wrinkles at the outer corners had become furrows. I hoped she didn't plan to give up academia if she made a killing writing thrillers. That would spoil the fun. How could scandal hurt a novelist? Little Miss Litchick finished reading her 3,000 words. She had the sense to keep her mouth shut while the rest of us made our comments. Then it was my turn to read. "Remind us briefly, Hester," Calendula said, "what's gone before. Remember, people, this is a work in progress. Nothing is final." "In chapter 1, I said, Marjorie confronts Hank with the size 4 bikini panties and accuses him of having an affair. He denies it. They have an ugly fight that ends with Hank storming out of the house. This is chapter 2. As I spoke, I handed out the print copies on which Calendula insisted during critique sessions. Ashley grasped hers the way a cat might, with the tips of her sharp, pearl-pink fingernails. "What's the title?" someone asked. "The Bigamist's Wife," I said. "Go ahead, Hester," Calendula said. "Chapter 2," I read aloud. As the door slammed, Marjorie sank into her favorite faded old club chair from the set she and Hank had chosen together. Hank had kicked the chair for emphasis as he shouted at her. When had the mild-mannered professor she had loved for 40 years become this violent stranger? Maybe it was time to let someone else put up with his temper tantrums. But she was damned if she'd make it easy for him. It was only a matter of time before she found out who his lover was.
Three master artists were in residence during this session: Calendula, a sculptor, and a choreographer. We all ate together in a rustic communal dining room, roofed but open on three sides to subtropical breezes, the constant rattling of the great fronds of palm and the forays of inquisitive geckos. The residencies were designed so that here we had one priority: our creative work. We had our solitary rooms with no Wi-Fi or cellular access to distract us. For critique, we had the workshops. Over meals, we had the community of our peers. The choreographers were dancers too, all of them young and limber. Most of the sculptors were in robust midlife, but a writer can be any age at all. Look at Keats, who died at 25. Look at Helen Hooven Sandmeyer, who published her one best-selling novel in her 80s. The Art Center's acceptance letter had made it very clear that we associates were there to hone our craft, not to network or promote our work. Don't come, it all but said, if you expect this residency to lead to mentoring, introductions to your master artist, agent, and editor, or any other boost up the ladder of ambition. The associates were therefore enthusiastic, friendly, and actually interested in literature and the arts. The food was good, and the whole community tended to linger in the dining room over coffee and interdisciplinary chit-chat. So I was able to avoid Ashley and still enjoy congenial company at meals. Still, she was hard to miss at mealtimes. Men invariably clustered around her. She dressed what my generation would have called provocatively. But I'd spent enough time on college campuses to know that for her age group, there was nothing out of line about perky nipples pushing through a stretchy cami or a plunging neckline revealing a curve of smooth-skinned breast. Nothing wrong with equally tight capris sitting so low at the so-called waist that her navel winked at passers-by. And it was obvious she'd body-waxed her nether parts. I'm no entomologist, but in my opinion, she emitted pheromones like a cockroach. And when Calendula sat down at an empty table, and our own Lolita was the first to plunk her tray down next to the master's, the other writers flocked. This was what we'd come for, wasn't it? To sit at the feet of genius? As long as we didn't ask about her agent. I'd have been a fool not to join them. I cast covert glances at Ashley from time to time. I didn't want her to catch me watching her. The men were listening to Calendula with reverent attention, but their eyes were still tracking Ashley's boobs. It was hard to tell if she was courting the attention or not. In my weaker moments, I thought it must have been those pheromones that had lured Jack in. At others, I was sure she must have blackmailed him somehow, or he would never have left me. Who knew an academic's secrets better than the research assistants who did his scut work in exchange for mentoring? He didn't want to let me go. I bet she didn't know that two or three times a month he still showed up at my kitchen door around 10 at night looking sheepish, and I would let him in and sleep with him. The real-life version of the fight scene in Chapter 1 had included one of those weird moments when ghosts of the Hester and Jack who had once been wild about each other made love. Two familiar bodies going through long-practiced moves. Was I going to use that scene? You bet I was. But I'd attended enough fiction workshops to know that planting a sex scene in the first chapter of a crime novel was a lousy idea, even worse than starting with a prologue. I tried not to look over at Ashley too often. I wanted this opportunity to work with Calendula Falk to be about my writing, not about that treacherous snake Jack and this insignificant little snippet who thought she had gotten him away from me. Except, of course, that they were grist for my fictional mill. She would have to listen to me read about her in the workshop, and she couldn't do one single damn thing about it. Then I would think Jack knew what a good thing he was giving up. He knew he was making himself ridiculous. He couldn't possibly count on her staying with him. Sooner or later, he'd have to come crawling home. Why was she still with him anyway? She had her doctorate and her tenure track position. Maybe she'd pair off with one of these buff young dancers or muscular sculptors on the weekend, when we didn't have workshops or communal meals. By the end of the residency, she'd have seen how much better she could do than fatuous in over his head going on elderly Jack. Then he'd beg me to take him back. I'd say I'd think about it. And when I did, would I ever let him forget my magnanimity? No fun in that. At dinner on Friday night, our last meal in the dining room until breakfast Monday morning, everyone was either abuzz with plans for the weekend or canvassing the others for suggestions. Some claimed they planned to write nonstop, others to sleep all weekend. There was an art museum in town, a nature reserve that sheltered alligators, and at least two restaurants that served them fried. I was lucky to have brought my car from New York, so I had complete mobility. Not all the residents did. On the long drive down I-95, I had thought perhaps I'd make a friend or two here. A woman who has been one of a couple for so long inevitably loses friends when she separates. And some of my closest women friends, I found, disapproved strongly of my refusal to give Jack a divorce. But Ashley's unexpected presence had rattled me. Calendula was magnificent, but the communal experience was not the fun that I'd expected. After 5 days digging into my memories and emotions and writing, even in fictional form, about wounds that were still raw, I needed to be alone. I couldn't skip the Friday night Artists Together event, at which the whole community gathered to present whatever they were up to. We got to walk through the sculptor's studio and watch some of the dancers perform each other's pieces, works in progress. The Arts Center administrators applauded everything and assured us we would be amazed at the changes we would see over the three-week period. Calendula had okayed our reading old material the first time, if the current work in progress felt too personal to share. I was one of those who chose to wait. The headliner each week was one of the master artists, so the rest of us, aspiring or emerging, could feel uplifted, humbled, or suicidal according to our gifts, our general emotional health, and what kind of medication we were on. After the formal gathering, they played dance music of enough variety to encourage the heterogeneous crowd to shake the kinks out, as the master sculptor put it. A 50-ish guy with a bushy black beard and a gleaming bald spot, he took to the floor with enthusiasm. Everyone danced. Calendula, clothed like a hippie goddess in batik draperies with her hair in an elaborate upsweep, shook an impressive number of jumbo pins out of her graying locks and let her long tresses swirl around her one way as her flowing garments swirled in the other. She beckoned to me to join her on the floor, and for a few minutes, flinging myself about with abandon, I managed to forget my woes. But it didn't last. As I sat on the sidelines, trying to catch my breath, I found myself much too close to the distasteful spectacle of a few of the men, including the master sculptor, begging Ashley to spend the weekend with them. The invitations ranged from an overnight jaunt to Orlando to dinner and dancing to the crude millennial hookup that I still find it hard to believe women ever really want. I heard her turn them all down. I also heard her decline an invitation to join a gaggle of writers heading for the beach, only 15 minutes away by car, on Saturday. I would have left, not wanting to be drafted to chauffeur the group, but I wanted to hear her excuse. "I'm expecting a visitor," she said. "If we make it to the beach, maybe, but no promises. I found that promises are fatal, haven't you?" The smug look that accompanied this zinger made my blood boil. It was all I could do to maintain a mask, act as if I didn't know it was aimed at me. The subtext, bluff or not, was that bigamy was an empty threat, that I was stuck with Jack and she was not. The visitor had to be Jack, unless she was simply toying with me. I managed not to grind my teeth or clench my fists
until I reached the safety of my room. Sure enough, when I staggered into the dining room on Saturday morning, the coffee pot, thank God, didn't take the weekend off, rubbing sleep crusts from my eyes, I nearly tripped over Jack's size 14 feet. Jack's big feet were comical, and I'd made many good-natured jokes, peppered with references to hobbits, Baba Yaga's hut, and darling Clementine about them over the past 40 years. In the current circumstances, we both snarled. "What the hell are you doing here?" he demanded. "Are you stalking me?" "That little twit didn't tell you?" I screeched. With an effort, I lowered my voice. "I'm here because Calendula Falk thinks I'm a good writer, and I've better things to do than go sniffing after you and your overripe Chiquita, who, by the way, is getting past her sell-by date." "She is not." "Ha!" I could still get a rise out of him. She was talking to a couple of her sculptor swains and hadn't seen me. "Oh, so she is underage. I wondered about that. Her writing is rather immature." "She is not underage, and you know it. Stop it, Hester. Look, this is absurd. What's done is done. Why can't we all accept that and get on with our lives?" "You mean, why can't I accept it?" My voice was smooth and cold as the highest quality gelato, a taste he and I had shared. Maybe Hank would bring Marjorie some as a peace offering when he came by to get back into her good graces, into her pants, that's how she'd think of it. And in the ensuing fight, she'd throw it smack in his face. It might be easier to move on if you didn't come tomcatting around to my place every time she has a headache or decides it's no fair cheating on her vibrator. "Jeez, Hester, what a tongue you've got on you. Where did that come from? You never used to be like this." "Maybe getting cheated on and dumped has made me cynical," I said. "Hester, you can't. There are reasons." "Hush, not in front of Ashley. Here she comes." I didn't want to play his game, especially if its goal was to protect poor little Ashley from having to hear mysterious reasons. But I didn't want to make a scene in front of my fellow writers and artists either. Jack had flown all this way to be with Ashley. He no doubt expected to spend every moment of the weekend glued to her. She might have other ideas. I'd find a way to get the reasons out of him. At the moment, they were billing and cooing like a pair of ill-matched turtle doves. I left them to it. I asked the groundskeeper, a local, for directions to the nature reserve. "Oh, you mean the swamp." And the name of the restaurant with the best alligator. "No name, we just call it the Fish Shack." The most appealing activity, I decided, would be a trip to the beach. The groundskeeper laughed when I asked about parking. "There's a ramp," he said. "You can drive your car right out on the beach." "Don't I need some kind of permit?" I asked. "It's just a Toyota Corolla. It doesn't have four-wheel drive or anything." He laughed again. "Don't you worry your pretty head about it, girl," he said. "It'll be fine. You'll see." He was probably younger than me, though his skin was so wrinkled and leathery from being out in the sun that he looked not unlike an alligator himself, snaggle teeth and all. But if he wanted to call a 62-year-old woman girl, I wasn't going to complain. I didn't even ask about changing rooms. Jones Beach, it wasn't. I got it. I put on my bathing suit in my room, threw a sundress and a big shirt over it, and popped clean underwear, a hairbrush, and sandals prettier than my flip-flops in my bag. After my swim, I change in the car or a gas station restroom and go out to dinner. I doubted I needed to get dolled up to eat fried alligator at a fish shack, but I liked to look moderately respectable when I dined out, even when I ate alone. The beach was the flattest that I'd ever seen. It bore no resemblance to the soft sand beaches of Long Island that I knew best. It was as flat as a parking lot. No wonder it made sense to drive your car down the ramp and pull up facing the ocean. The parking dispensation ended farther down the beach, where the Cape Canaveral National Seashore began, so I had picked the right spot. The water was warm and tasted different from the same Atlantic Ocean in the Northeast. The color was different, too. Not the deep jade I was used to, but a whitish blue-green like Pernod, maybe absinthe, one of those licorice-tasting French drinks that go cloudy when you add water. I could swim in it, but I found it disappointing. The beach wasn't good for sunbathing either, like napping on a gym floor. I didn't get there until 3 p.m, since I'd done some writing first. I'd taken notes on how I felt about Jack's arrival, every shifting nuance. Marjorie wasn't me, and Hank wasn't Jack exactly, but the more I understood Hester and Jack, the more lifelike I'd be able to make Marjorie and Hank. I hadn't named the Ashley avatar yet. Too much rage came up when I thought about her. In my notes, she figured as the homewrecker. I'd skipped lunch, so I bought some fried shrimp at a stand on the beachfront road before driving onto the beach. Deep-fried pickle chips didn't tempt me, but I made a note. Maybe I'd use them in the novel. Maybe I'd use them to poison the homewrecker. By the time I'd parked and applied sunblock and arranged my towel and beach bag to my satisfaction, the not very crowded beach was emptying and the light turning golden as the day began to wane. I looked for the gang from the arts center but didn't spot them until they emerged from the water 200 or 300 yards down the beach, laughing, splashing each other, and throwing a bright red beach ball around. I would have gone over, but I could see them toweling themselves off and beginning to gather up their things rather than settling back down on their blankets. They were probably going to a bar to have a few drinks before dinner. I had come for a swim, and strange tasting water or not, I would have it. I swam what would have been laps if I'd been confined to a pool. In fact, I swam what must have been half a mile parallel to the beach before I turned and swam back. When I came out of the water, the beach was almost empty. I had extra towels in the car. I rolled up and arranged one under my neck and another under my knees so that I was not much more uncomfortable than if I'd been lying on my back on a yoga mat. I closed my eyes. Hester, I squinted upward. Jack stood towering over me like a giant palm tree, backlit by golden light. Where's Chiquita? I said. Don't call her that. Lolita, then. Would you rather talk about how you betrayed me? And what are your reasons? What are you talking about? She wanted to write, so I came for a swim. I didn't betray you. I just, damn it, try to understand. I sat up and scrubbed at my face with my hands. I was wide awake now. Understand what, Jack? Did you think you'd find the fountain of youth in Florida? Are you hurt because she loves her laptop better than you? Because her own writing is what turns her on? I can understand that. He whirled, his big duck-like feet flapping on the hard-packed sand as he hurried toward the water. I'm going for a swim. I'll come with you. I tucked my anatomy more firmly into my suit and hurried after him. He had always liked to show off in the water. He wasn't a bad swimmer, but I was much better. Together, we'd horsed around a lot. Angry as we were at each other right now, the sexual tension was still there. He would tell me what I wanted to know, and then we'd see. Come on, Jack, truce. Let's just swim. With a glance over my shoulder, I took off in an easy crawl, parallel to the shore. He caught up with me, I let him, and we swam in tandem, maybe half as far as I'd come on my own. Then I flipped and headed back the other way. He kept pace with me. When we reached roughly the point where we'd entered the water, we found our feet and stood looking at each other almost amicably. The water wasn't deep this close to shore, up to my waist, Jack's hips. Jack. What? I grinned at him. I'm a porpoise. Spread your legs. Are you crazy? It was a silly trick we hadn't done in years, but he instinctively spread his legs, and I did a porpoise dive and swam underwater through them, popping up behind him. I burst through to the surface, sputtering and spitting water. Laugh, I said, chortling myself. You know you want to. Come on, now you. In a minute or two, we were playing like a couple of kids, our enmity forgotten for the moment. At least, I hoped he'd forgotten it, because I had an end game in mind. Bend over, I said. Come on, Jack, bend over. I want to climb onto your shoulders and dive. Remember we used to do this? I'm too old for this, Hester. Oh, all right, here, give me your hands. I climbed onto his shoulders and shook my hands free of his, resting them lightly on his head instead. Then I wrapped my legs around his neck and squeezed. Ow! Hester! That's too tight! Ah! You're choking me! Hester! His face started turning red, but I didn't stop. I grabbed two chunks of his hair in my fists and pulled as hard as I could. What reasons, damn you? What's the secret that's so important fragile little Ashley can't know, but I'm supposed to sacrifice myself and give you a divorce? He gagged and tried to speak, waved his hands to indicate that if I didn't give him any air, he wouldn't be able to tell me. He had a point. I eased my thighs apart a little, but tugged on his hair harder. Don't think for one second that I care if I hurt you, Jack. You've hurt me plenty. Now tell me. It's not a secret from her, he gasped. It just wasn't something we'd want to talk about in front of everyone at that place. Oh, God, Hester, you're going to be so angry. I was afraid to tell you, and I was right. But don't you see? I have to have the divorce. We need to get married. I got it. He didn't have to say it. I was so shocked that my muscles went limp around his neck. It was just for a moment, but he seized the chance and slithered down and out from under me through the water. He swam away from me in a panicked crawl, heading out to sea. We had no children. I had had three miscarriages and a stillborn baby boy, then a girl who died of SIDS at 7 months. We had gone through all those tragedies together. And now the perky little homewrecker was pregnant with Jack's baby. I would never give him a divorce. That was final. Don't kill me, don't kill me, he had been babbling before he started swimming away. Could I have killed Jack then? Could I ever? Could I kill her, myself? It seemed likely that she would want to kill me. We're supposed to feel weightless or close to it in water, but I felt as if I were wearing lead weights as I dragged myself back toward shore. Absorbed in my thoughts, I didn't notice for a while that now mine was the only car on the beach. I looked back out to sea. At first, I couldn't see Jack. I felt a queer flutter in my stomach. He couldn't have continued straight out to deep water without realizing it, could he? His eyesight had gotten very bad in the last couple of years, and of course he didn't wear his glasses in the water. They were right here, wrapped up in his t-shirt. He couldn't be that much of an idiot, could he? I peered and squinted until I spotted him, feeling the thump of relief, oddly, not in my gut, but in my heart, when I saw he was swimming parallel to the shore. He was quite far out, where the water was deeper, head down so he could stroke more powerfully. That was Jack, so busy showing off that he forgot to look where he was going. He forgot to look for danger. Among the Florida stories we'd all heard since our arrival, along with the alligator tales, were the frequent sightings of sharks close to shore. Beachgoers saw them all the time around here. Normally, anyone who saw them would yell, "Shark! Shark! Everyone out of the water!" This time, there was nobody to yell but me. Our lives are works in progress, not just what we do and don't do, but the complex choreography of our dance with other people and the shaping and reshaping of our emotions. We live these moments and then we transform them, not once but many times, by describing them in any of an infinite number of possible ways. And what about emotions that we can never express at all? I stood watching the milky blue-green sea for some time, trying to know what I truly felt. Anger, pity, detachment, loss. My eyesight is still perfect. I could see the ominous dark fins, three of them in formation, slicing the water. The sharks were heading right for him. The fried alligator at the fish shack was tough. Not the treat I had expected. I won't try it again. I wanted to have a strong sense of place. So I wrote this description, meaning it to be a very different kind of story. And I wrote one paragraph, and I thought, I can't keep this up. This is not the way I write. It will bore me to death to try. And I know what my strengths are, voice and character. And I looked into the well, and Hester jumped right out. I would love to talk about my upcoming anthology. It's called Me Too Short Stories. And the log line, which is not part of the title because we realized we couldn't fit it on the cover, is Crimes Against Women, Tales of Retribution and Healing. And I wrote a story first, which gave a voice to a protagonist, as it turned out when I realized the story needed to be complex, two protagonists who had been abused, women protagonists who had been abused since they were children. And I realized there was no place to send it. It was too raw for the Dell magazines and the noir magazines. They'll take any kind of horror and graphic violence, and then they'll say no abuse of children. Well, children are abused. And what we need to do is not avert our eyes, but let them speak. And the idea of doing this anthology myself came to me. And I found that women were eager to write about this and to read it. So Level Best Books is doing it. It will be out in September, and I'm very excited about it. But I worked very closely with the authors who answered my call for submissions. And the key was really to get stories that were not fictionalized testimony. These are not accounts of Me Too experiences. They're short stories. And that was the thing that I felt had never been done. You know, Me Too type novels about abuse and assault and women survivors have become trendy. But in short stories, you simply don't see it. So that's the thing that we have to offer that's special.
That was Elizabeth Selvin reading her story, A Work in Progress, from the May-June 2019 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. If you've enjoyed listening to this story, you'll find many more from the magazine at our website, alfredhitchcockmysterymagazine.com. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published by Dell Magazines and Penny Publications. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital editions are available at all major e-tailers. This podcast was produced with the help of Ray Purdom and our managing editor, Jackie Sherbell. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.